This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Iowa U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. Learn more about the benefits of the sugar industry to the nation at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Senator Joni Ernst next. America's 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers produce sugar under some of the world's strictest safety, labor, and environmental standards. The industry also supports 151,000 jobs across more than two dozen states. The farmer, family, and employee-owned sugar companies pay workers fair wages and offer good benefits, including union jobs in rural and urban communities. Together, farmers and workers provide a reliable domestic sugar supply chain for both food manufacturers and grocery store shoppers. A strong bipartisan coalition in Congress supports sugar policy, which is the safety net for sugar producers in the Farm Bill. The sugar program is designed to have zero cost to the taxpayer and has the flexibility to allow for a reliable supply of sugar throughout the year. Sugar policy ensures Americans are not dependent on unreliable foreign supplies, which would displace American farmers and jobs and jeopardize domestic food security for this essential ingredient. For more, visit the American Sugar Alliance at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The U.S. Congress was successful in avoiding a government shutdown last week, but so far fallen short of approving a new farm bill. Iowa Senator Joni Ernst hopes for better chances in 2025. On trade, Ernst is very displeased with the growing U.S. ag trade deficit and says the Biden administration isn't making trade a priority.
I think this is horrible, and I'm up in arms about this. The USDA is predicting about a $30.5 billion trade deficit in ag for this current fiscal year, and I am really fed up with the administration not engaging as we need them to in foreign trade. You know, I look at all of my folks that are out there. They are working hard. They're raising corn, soybeans, beef, poultry, pork, you name it, whatever it is. They need access to those foreign markets. And I'm just a very fierce advocate for reducing these trade barriers for U.S. products in markets abroad. But what we are seeing from the administration is that they have failed to prioritize our ag trade. That's why we're seeing these deficits. And I have joined my colleagues in calling on our U.S. trade rep, Catherine Tai, and our USDA secretary, Tom Vilsack, to increase our ag exports and make sure that we're improving competitiveness of all of our products abroad.
Senator, do you think the Congress would agree on trade promotion authority for this administration?
Well, I think we would. I really think it's important, and we need to bolster that program. But what I have heard from Catherine Tai in the past is that we will not see any new trade agreements in this first Biden administration. But again, we need to continue to push this with the USTR and USDA. We've got to increase our access to these foreign markets.
I understand what's possible, but when do you think is the best chance to get a farm bill passed?
Well, you know, Senator Chuck Grassley and I talk about this a lot. We both sit on the Ag Committee. I have sat individually with Senator John Bozeman, who's our ranking member. I've sat down with our chairwoman, Debbie Stabenow, who's a Democrat from Michigan. And I don't see the groups coming together right now. And this is very frustrating as well. And I think the best opportunity may be for us to proceed in this next Congress in January. It's not when I want to see it move forward, but honestly, Jeff, I think this is when we do see it move forward.
Well, when I talked to former Congressman Colin Peterson, the former chair of the Ag Committee,
he said there would have to be movement to the middle of the road. And he said the only thing in the middle of the road are yellow lines and dead animals. So whether the outcome of the election shifts red or blue, the question is, where does the money come from to be able to resolve the need that's in place?
Well, this is the issue, and this is the struggle that I have seen on the Senate Ag Committee, is that we've got people firmly dug into their camps. And bottom line, Jeff, if you look at the overall price tag of this farm bill, it's at $1.5 trillion. Now, the last farm bill we passed 5 years ago was somewhere around $890 billion, which is a pretty significant price tag already. But in 5 years, we've nearly doubled the cost of the farm bill. And let me tell you, that's not going to farm programs. Only about 14% of this current $1.5 trillion bill goes to farm programs. So I can tell you where I think some of those funds need to come from, and we can't pay for the whole bill on its own. So I would like to see a little more shift coming from some of the climate programs, some of the food programs. There are ways we can support the families in need, but some of that does need to shift back to the farm, and I'll keep pushing that.
The EPA has offered now its new tailpipe emission standards. The first I would ask is, does the EPA have that much authority, and how do you feel about the numbers that they've offered?
Well, Jeff, whether they have the authority or not, they're going after it. So they have this rule that they will be released. Well, they released the rule in last year. But what they're looking at is a finalized rule by this Wednesday. And they're not listening to stakeholder comments. And I have a lot of comments on my own, and I'm not very eloquent in talking about it. But what I'll tell you, and this is how I feel about it, is that looking at electric vehicles, well, of course, we know they don't have tailpipe emissions. Hello, they're electric vehicles. So actually comparing an EV to a liquid-fueled car or truck, you can't compare. You're comparing a pineapple to a beet. So it's just completely out of line. What we should do is take a look at the carbon footprint that comes from those EVs from the point they start digging into mines in Africa and using child and slave labor to do that mining. Look at all of those emissions from the very start of a program to putting that electric battery together that's manufactured in China, shipping it to the United States or wherever to put together. We should look at that entire carbon footprint, compare it, EVs versus liquid fuels. Then we'll maybe have a good comparison.
There are implications, and Senator Grassley said that this effort would lead to $224 billion in increase of the deficit, first of all, for tax credits for the purchase of the EVs, and second of all, the loss in gas tax revenues.
Absolutely. And Senator Grassley is spot on with that. And the really sad thing about this is with a lot of the credits that are going to the purchase of these electric vehicles, most of those credits, of course, are going to individuals or families that make six figures or more every single year, because the people that are buying these vehicles are those that are much wealthier. If you look at the average cost of an electric vehicle at $56,000, that's more than the median income for a family of four based in little old Montgomery County, Iowa, where I'm from. Those are not the families that are purchasing EVs. So I think there's a lot of economic implications to the purchase and the rewarding that's going to those families that are buying those cars.
Some of the data from the University of Nebraska and their study show some ripple effects. First of all, that less demand for ethanol would mean lower corn prices, and that in turn would mean lower land values. They quote even up to $100 billion in the top five corn-producing states.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I can see where that does have a domino effect, a ripple effect through our economy. I come from a farm family, as I said, in Montgomery County, Iowa, and we have to have the demand out there for our corn, for our soybeans, if you're looking at biodiesel, whatever it might happen to be. So the administration is out there focusing on their electric vehicles. And what Secretary Vilsack has said in the past is, okay, so maybe we don't need as much corn ethanol. What we'll do is flip a switch and we'll go to sustainable aviation fuel. And as I'm talking to my guys and gals back home in Iowa, those that are producing ethanol, they say, you know, Joni, it's not as simple as flipping a switch. You would have to level the plants that are in existence now that could produce the corn ethanol and revamp entirely to produce sustainable aviation fuel. So I get the ripple effect. I think it's horrible. I think we have a readily available resource at our fingertips right now. It's available at the pump. If we can get E15 year round this year, and of course moving forward in the next year, we're going to provide a great market for corn ethanol. But if he turns his back on it, it's going to hurt our farmers.
But you turn now and consider that the Treasury's ruling on amending the GREET model will determine whether renewable fuels like ethanol or soybean-based biodiesel would be able to be used for sustainable aviation fuel. What of the delay in the amended GREET model?
Well, and this is, they need to get on with that. We need to just go ahead and adopt the GREET model now. I've been working on this for a long time to make sure that our America's domestic energy production is driven by the U.S. GREET model rather than, you know, a different international model that is being dictated to us by other countries. Like our adversaries, you know, like China and Russia, they are the ones that are forcing this issue. And I have a bipartisan effort to make sure that we're expanding those opportunities for investment in the SAF, in the sustainable aviation fuels, at USDA. So I believe we need to do this. We need to make sure, GREET is adopted as soon as possible. They shouldn't keep delaying. They can't keep doing that to our farmers and our ethanol production, corn ethanol.
I'm still in the same subject then. EPA thus far has been lagging on approving year-round E15 sales for the nation. Do you see a reason?
No, I don't, other than they just don't want to do it. Jeff, this is the really tough part about this administration, is they are going to drag their feet because there are still the folks on the far left. It does not matter what the product is. They certainly don't want to see liquid fuels, because even if we have E15, we're still utilizing petroleum products. They are such hardliners that even though using E15 decreases the carbon footprint of our vehicles, they still don't want to see it. So I am really frustrated. The EPA, they should have made sure that we had E15 year-round. They should have started it this year instead of forcing us to go to another emergency waiver. I know we'll see it in 2025. They have said that. But again, they're dragging their feet because they'd rather see the extinction of the, no pun intended, of the fossil fuels and liquid fuels, including E15, and drive forward with electric vehicles.
I realize that I'm asking an Iowa senator this question, so I anticipate the answer, but I would like to ask, what if the renewable fuel industry loses the transportation market or is greatly reduced? And what if renewable fuel is not able to participate in the aviation fuel market? What does that spell for rural America?
I think it really spells a decline in our rural areas, period. And I just can't imagine that the administration, any administration, would want to do that. And if their goal is a cleaner environment, then ethanol, biofuels, all of it needs to be part of that solution. they are so ignorant if they won't embrace it. Because as I've spelled out for you before, electric vehicles and their carbon footprint on the world, with the mining for rare earth minerals, and the use of child and slave labor, it's morally reprehensible. So we really need to support our rural communities, and a healthy part of that is E15. It is ethanol, corn ethanol products. It is biofuels. Whether you're looking at corn stover and biomass, if you're looking at soybeans, we have these resources that can be grown every single year. We should be using them.
How do you feel shifting to the Department of Agriculture about the changes suggested under the Packers and Stockyards Act?
Well, we have more work to do with that yet. And Senator Grassley has been a real champion on this. We've worked a lot with Deb Fisher as well. And so we will keep working through this. But again, what we need to know with USDA, with those that are out there making rules and regulations, and even those of us in Congress, making sure that we have our cattlemen working for them in the best possible manner we can. We have differences, obviously, between those cattlemen in the north and the packers that we utilize and those that you find in the south. So, again, we're going to have to work really hard to make sure that the benefit is going to those cattlemen that are really seeing some tough times out there. So we've got to figure out the right way to move forward.
Are you supportive of the product of the USA label or Made in USA that's been offered, the voluntary labels?
Well, again, we've got some differences there as well. And I know we will hear from folks that say it's all voluntary, but there are those that will come from the other side, especially those that maybe are a little further up north or do finishing here in the United States, but maybe the cattle have been fed in Canada. I'm hearing from all different sides of that. So we're going to have to dig a little deeper into that, make sure, of course, we want to support cattle that are coming from the U.S. of A., but understand, you know, what those differences would be if part of that overall life cycle of that beef is either in the United States, Mexico, Canada. We've got to figure it out.
Senator, you and Senator Grassley have been somewhat critical of USDA employees working remotely. What's the resolution to that situation and your challenge?
Well, my challenge is making sure that we get people back to work. And I had Secretary Tom Vilsack in front of us just a few weeks ago. And I asked him about this because so many of those offices at the USDA are sitting empty. And according to a GAO, the Accountability Office, they gave us a report last fall. And it said that the USDA headquarters is only using 11% of their in-person office space. So I read that report to Secretary Vilsack. He immediately bristled up. He got very defensive and said, "Oh, are you accusing my workers of not working?" And I said, "Well, I'm not. I'm personally not. I'm just reading what the Government Accountability Office is saying." So Secretary Vilsack denied this trend at this Ag Committee hearing, but I had heard from a supervisor at the USDA who anonymously contacted my office, and he compared his experience at the agency in Washington, D.C. to a ghost town. And he said there are many emails and phone calls that are simply not being answered because people are not at work. So we've got to get all these bureaucrats back into the office and being responsive to the constituencies that they represent.
Senator Ernst, I understand that as we celebrated National Agriculture Day recently, you went a step further to celebrate women in agriculture. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you, and I appreciate that. Yes, so this last week we celebrated National Women in Ag Day, and I am very proud that my effort passed the Senate unanimously, and I'm grateful for the support of all of our female senators. They all signed on as co-sponsors, and the effort was led by myself and Senator Tina Smith, a Democrat coming from Minnesota. And the resolution honors a million women nationwide, and we have nearly 50,000 of those wonderful women in ag in Iowa alone. So what we are attempting to do is, of course, recognize women in ag, but encouraging the next generation of women. We need these young women coming into our fields, our labs, and our classrooms. So really, really proud of that accomplishment. And women out there, whether you're a farmer or rancher, we salute you.
Senator Ernst, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. It's Open Mic. You've been here before, and today you have the last word.
Thank you so much. God bless our farmers and ranchers. We will keep working for you diligently in the United States Senate, and I appreciate the support I get from all of our great Iowa farmers and farm families and all of those wonderful industries and businesses connected to ag. Jeff, thanks so much for the time.
Our thanks to Iowa U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. Learn more about the benefits of the sugar industry to the nation at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nelly.